sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Our card this week is Deborah Perry, the King of Spades from South Carolina. Now, many of you may recognize my voice from other Audiochuck shows like Counterclock, Season 7 literally just kicked off last month, or Park Predators, our summer show, which is now a weekly show. I know last week you heard from Kylie Lowe, host of Dark Down East. Well, this week, Ashley is passing the mic over to me to tell you about a cold case from the Carolinas that needs your attention. For 30 years, the unsolved murder of a young mother found shot to death on an isolated South Carolina cul-de-sac has haunted her family. They feared they'd carry the mystery of Deborah's death to their own graves. That is, until our investigation raised new questions and sparked fresh hope. I'm Delia D'Ambra, and this is The Deck. At 11:20 a.m. on Sunday, October 23, 1994, two officers from the Richland County Sheriff's Department responded to a call about a possible homicide on quiet rural Chartel Circle. As they pulled towards the end of the one-block street, they spotted something eerie that honestly sounds like a scene from a horror movie. Four people standing at the edge of a cul-de-sac, all pointing in the same direction, at the body of a young woman lying motionless on the asphalt.
He walked up and the first thing he noticed was blood around the head of this female, partially clothed, shoes and other clothing materials awry around her body. I'm pretty sure that the first thing he thought, oh, this is a murder, not like an accident or something. It looks pretty heinous.
That's Richland County Sheriff's Department cold case investigator Jeff Fuller. He said when the officers took a closer look, they saw the woman had an apparent gunshot wound to the head, a likely source for all that blood pooled under it. And there was so much blood. He said there was no doubt she'd been shot right there where she lay now. The young woman was wearing a white crew neck sweatshirt with a black bra underneath, but she was nude from the waist down, except for the socks on her feet and a pair of blue and green flower-printed pants clutched against her chest and draped over her torso.
It looks like she's trying to cover herself up. So apparently that was done before she was shot, because she was shot in such a manner that she couldn't do it afterwards, I don't think.
There was no size marked on the tag of the pants, but when police carefully removed them from her grasp, they found a pair of men's briefs, size 32-34 waist, that were inside. As far as what else they gathered from around the scene, it was kind of a mixed bag. Some items felt significant, but they also had to wade through a lot of trash that was scattered around the general area. For some context, the cul-de-sac itself was surrounded only by weeds and woods, and the area seemed to be a popular spot for the things people do in the dark.
Those remote areas attract people doing things surreptitiously, whether they're making out or drinking beer or doing drugs. It's everywhere on those kind of areas. It's kind of like going to a state park and trying to figure out Joe Smith's beer can out of all those that are laying around. It's hard to do.
Officers gathered more than a dozen items from the general vicinity, including beer cans, some discarded clothing, and a towel found along the edge of the woods. They didn't know if any of that would relate to their victim, but better safe than sorry. There were some other items closer to where she was found, though, that felt more promising. Officers collected two 9mm shell casings, one from under her head and one by her feet. They also collected a condom and a condom wrapper and a pair of white high-top sneakers that had been placed on the soles side by side near her feet. Officers also photographed some tire skid marks on the pavement at the entrance to the cul-de-sac, more than 50 feet from where she lay. The only other physical evidence they got would come from her autopsy. According to that report, she appeared to have been pretty healthy before her death. The coroner found she'd actually been shot twice in the head. The first bullet entered her left cheek and exited just above her right ear, and the second entered the right side of her head near the top of her skull. That one was found lodged around her left cheekbone. The location and upward angle of the first gunshot wound told investigators she was likely in a car and possibly trying to get out when she was shot.
Now, at this point, you don't know if that's a fatal shot. It could have gone through the sinus cavities. It probably was a fatal shot shortly, but then is the person jumping out of the car when this happens and the head's tilted down making that shot? How does that get to be at that angle? Are they jumping out and get shot? And then I think you could make a very high percentage guess that once the person was on the ground, there was a shot to the head.
Now, a sexual assault exam didn't provide any forensic evidence, and her nails were too short to be tested. But after running her fingerprints, they finally got a name: Deborah Perry. She was 29 years old and had gotten into some legal trouble for forged checks a couple of years prior. That's why they had her prints. Along with her name, they got an address where she'd last been living, 7 miles from Chartel Circle. A few residents in the area reportedly saw her leaving home the night before, Saturday, October 22nd. She told at least one of them she was going to make a phone call, and this is 1994, so she was probably heading to use a payphone at a nearby corner store. But who she called, where she called from, how she got from there to Chartel Circle, and why she was there at all is a mystery. It's not an easy walk from that apartment to the cul-de-sac, and it isn't somewhere you just happen to come across, which would indicate she got there by car. Fuller told us investigators learned she might have known people in the Chartel Circle area and been involved in sex work. And a toxicology report came back positive for cocaine in her system, so maybe she was there to purchase from someone or to meet a client and things got out of hand. There were too many questions and not enough answers, but investigators hoped her family might be able to give them more. Soon after Deborah was identified, Richland County investigators learned she had 7 children, all of whom were in foster care, having been removed from her care sometime after her arrest for the forgery charge. The father of her children, a guy named Danny Davis, was in prison on an accessory to robbery charge. So they contacted Danny's sister, Jennifer Davis, who would end up helping raise Deborah's children along with her mom and her grandmother. Jennifer actually went down to the morgue to identify Deborah. Deborah's hair was cut very short, and that wasn't the only physical change since Jennifer had last seen her several years earlier.
She had lost a whole lot of weight, like she just was running, you know, just in the streets, just running. It was terrible. I can say I'm a tough cookie. And I've been in the nursing field also, so I guess I was able to handle that.
That was Jennifer, and after speaking with her and the family, investigators learned Deborah's struggles began early. She'd grown up in New York City, close to Jennifer and Danny's family. Jennifer told us she'd actually visited the Perry family apartment in the late 1970s or early 80s.
I noticed that it was not a home, not the way that my mom had a home. My mom had a home. You understand what I mean? Like, when we walked into her home, there was no furniture. The walls were dark. There was one mattress on the floor in the living room. So when she took us into the kitchen, there was just a small little table there with a bottle of Thunderbird, ashes, and an ashtray. She opened up the refrigerator like a young kid would, you know? And when she opened up the refrigerator, me and my siblings were standing there. There was nothing in the refrigerator. No supervision because her mom was on drugs. And when I did see her mom was getting high with her brothers. So that would be Deborah's uncles. And they would be sitting outside playing music, getting high. It was always like on a Friday.
By the time she was 10 or 11, Deborah had fallen into the same habits as the rest of her family. And when she and Danny started dating when they were both young teens, he fell into those habits too.
I've always asked him from time to time, you know, why did you turn to drugs when she introduced it to you? And he said he loved her. And he felt that if this is what she's doing, then I need to do the same thing that she's doing. That was his mindset.
By 1984, Danny and Deborah had 3 kids and were bouncing from shelter to shelter in New York. So Jennifer's mom sent them money to help them relocate to South Carolina, where she and Jennifer were living at the time. The family was hoping a new start would mean a fresh start for Danny and Deborah, but it wasn't. The substance abuse continued. Both had run-ins with the law, and Deborah had 4 more children before her life was cut short. She had visits with the children, Jennifer said, but no one in the family knew much about the details of her life in the final few years. With little information from family, investigators also struggled to find solid leads, and the few solid leads they did have, Detective Fuller couldn't tell us much about. For instance, according to the case file, on November 10th, they brought in a man for a polygraph. He'd been arrested by the Richland County Sheriff's Office in 1990, but the file doesn't say what the charge was, and Fuller didn't know either. We do know the results of that polygraph test showed deceptive intent. If investigators dug more into this guy, I can't say. There's nothing in the file about an alibi, and the absence of any other information about him from that point on makes it seem like investigators thought he was a dead end. They ended up determining that the 2 9mm bullets used in the murder came from the same gun, a Luger. We know they tested them against 2 weapons that Detective Fuller says were used in another crime. It was just standard procedure to run the comparison, I guess. So they weren't necessarily surprised when neither was a match. And those shoes found near Deborah's body were assumed to be hers, but there's no record of any forensic testing on them. Forensic testing on the condom, the beer cans, and the other items they found towards the edge of the woods also led nowhere. And the flowered pants, those were still a big question mark. Based on our research, it seems pretty likely these pants, which didn't have a fly, are women's, but that doesn't fully explain the men's underwear inside of them. Sure, they could have been hers, but it was never determined. And investigators didn't do any initial testing on a spot of blood on the pants. In fact, they either didn't notice it or assumed all the blood came from Deborah, which I know feels a little infuriating, but this was the early 90s. The use of DNA testing in cases was a precious resource, not always utilized for pick your favorite reason. So it's not all that surprising that Deborah's case went cold. Her kids grew up without their mom and believed they'd never get answers about what happened to her. But in 2009, they saw on the news that her case had been reopened, and the Richland County Sheriff's Department was asking for tips. According to that story on News 19 in Columbia, police had spoken with a witness who claimed to have seen a man with a medium build walking on Chartel Circle the night of Deborah's murder. And get this, the witness said the man was wearing flowered pants. Deborah's daughter, Janetta Holmes, told us that detail made her stop in her tracks. Not because she knew her mom had been found with flowered pants. In fact, she'd never heard that detail. It was because she knew a man who'd regularly worn flowered pants back when her mom was killed. It was someone her mom had been romantically involved with. We'll call this man Gerald. And Janetta's aunt Jennifer said he operated a club where Deborah worked for a time when she and Danny were broken up, and Danny was in prison. Gerald was married when he and Deborah got involved, but he had a temper and may not have liked that Deborah was also involved with other men. Jennifer believes that jealousy could have been a motive for the murder.
Just kind of picture, if a man knows that you're a cheating woman, you're a woman that runs the streets, you're with all kinds of men, and you are on drugs, but he loves you, and he catches you out there with another man. So now he's just to the point where he's getting crazier and crazier. He fights you because he did fight her. He was abusing her physically, and for him to see whatever he seen, I guess he could have shot her.
It felt like a solid theory, and Janetta says a family member did go to police with it, but they never heard if investigators did anything with the tip. Well, we found out that they had done something. You see, by 2009, when they got this tip from family, they'd already had new forensic testing done on the crime scene evidence. They'd learned that spot of blood on the pants had actually come from a man, and they even had a partial DNA profile. So once they got the tip about Gerald, they went and got a DNA sample from him, but it was not a match. Fuller didn't know if investigators had asked Gerald if the pants and underwear found with Deborah belonged to him, so we tried to reach Gerald for ourselves to see if Deborah could have borrowed his clothes on a previous visit. But as of this recording, we haven't been able to make contact with him. As for the witness who claimed to have seen a man walking in flowered pants on Chartel Circle the night of the crime, it's possible that person actually saw Deborah. At 5 feet, 2 inches and 130 pounds, she was definitely smaller than a man with a medium build, but since her hair was cut in a pixie cut, it's possible that the witness just mistook her for a guy from afar. The man in the flowered pants might be a dead end, but it wasn't the family's only theory. And some of the other theories they had, they'd never shared with police, but they did share them with us. Not long after Jennifer identified Deborah in the morgue and noticed her short hair, she'd heard a disturbing story that Deborah had been attacked by a group of girls who cut off her hair. But if Deborah had been involved in some ongoing feud, there was no record of it in the case file, and Jennifer didn't know the names of the alleged attackers. Jennifer also told us that soon after Deborah was murdered, a relative overheard a man discussing the crime and claiming he was present when it happened. But the relative was too scared to tell her who it was, for fear that they'd be killed. And she said Danny had an encounter while he was locked up with someone who knew about Deborah's murder.
He told me there were guys talking, because you know in jail they find out everything that's going on in the streets. There were some guys talking about the situation and what happened to her.
Danny's out of prison now and living in Burlington, Vermont, so our reporter Madison gave him a call, and he agreed to talk. He said that back around 1997, he was working in the wood shop in a prison in Greenville, South Carolina. A guy in the shop overheard Danny saying that the mother of his children had been murdered near Columbia. Here's Danny recalling hearing this.
And the guy was like, "You know, I just heard you say that your children's mother night before." I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "Well, I know a lady who had children too." But then he's like, "Yo, was she with her children?" I said, "No, her children was with my mom." He's like, "Yo, I think I know who you're talking about."
Danny said when he showed the guy a picture of Deborah, the guy said, "I know her." He told Danny he'd been in a relationship with Deborah while Danny was locked up and that they'd gone to New York together. And he thought Deborah might have been running drugs.
He's like, "Yo, she, for all I know, she went to get a key of coke and a key of heroin." And he said, "Yo, when she got back, he said, this cat robbed her and they murdered her." And he said, "The kid that I believe did it, he got murdered too." I'm like, "Really?"
But despite this, there's absolutely no way for us to know if either one of these guys, the relative who claimed he overheard someone admitting to the murder, or the guy Danny met in prison, actually know anything about it. But Danny and Deborah's daughter, Janetta, believes there could be something there. Her dad doesn't remember the name of the guy he talked to in prison, and he doesn't know the name of the kid who was the alleged trigger man, who also got murdered. But he does have at least partial names for the people who supposedly set it up.
One went by the name of Milton, and another guy went by the name of Polo. They were the two big dog drug dealers in Columbia. They went by those nicknames.
Jennifer also thinks the story the guy in prison told Danny is plausible based on what Danny has told her about Deborah and her drug dealings over the years.
From what he said to me, what I can remember is that the guy started talking to him and telling him that she was rough. She was a rough cookie. And also that whoever the guys were that was trying to, I guess, put her on to selling with them or selling for them, they pulled a gun out on her. And before they could pull, she had already pulled. So they said, "Oh, so you're a roughneck. You know, you don't play. So it's like, we want you on our team." So I guess that's when she got initiated in, or whatever the case may be. They trusted her, probably gave her drugs to sell, not realizing that she was on drugs. And like any other, you know, drug deal gone bad, she probably used it. When they were looking for their money, she had already used it.
It certainly wouldn't be the first time a drug deal gone bad turned into a murder. But there's really no way to verify any of this since we don't know who Milton or Polo are. So put all that information firmly in the rumor category. Fuller hadn't heard those names either, so after our team spoke with Jennifer, Janetta, and the rest of the family, we made sure to put them back in touch with the Richland County Sheriff's Department so investigators could follow up on any new leads. And there is still hope for new leads. In 2022, Fuller was reviewing cold cases and realized there was evidence in Deborah's case that could be retested for familial DNA links to a suspect. He sent the male blood found at the scene for additional analysis, hoping new technology would provide a break.
The blood was sent for DNA analysis beyond the capability of our lab because it was so degraded that special extraction techniques had to be done. It took 3 times to get that done to the point that any kind of genome count at all, and it was very, very low. There's simply not enough information in the match data to generate additional leads on the identity of the subject. Now, it may change as people donate, get their DNA in the public.
Fuller said that DNA testing conducted on the men's underwear in 2010 was a bust, but the underwear wasn't submitted for new testing in 2022 along with the blood stain from the pants. And Fuller said he's now checking to see if it can be retested to determine who was wearing it, Deborah or a suspect. Janetta and her family are hoping that new forensic technology will provide a break in the case, or that new witnesses will come forward with information that leads to Deborah's killer. Janetta grew up living with her paternal great-grandmother and is now 36 and a mother herself. She's broken the cycle of poverty and addiction that had such a devastating impact on her mother's short life. Her Aunt Jennifer and grandmother Maddie are proud and think Deborah would be too.
But this one,
oh yeah,
was raised by my father's mother, and she have instilled all of those old values. She can cook her behind off.
No.
Listen, she takes care of her kids. They
yes.
are so loving and caring, and oh my goodness. So out of all of her siblings, she's the mother.
Janetta believes her mother wanted to do better by her children and might have had she had the chance.
Even though my aunts and my grandmother stepped up, they did everything they could, it still doesn't take the place of having my biological mother. And, you know, still yet things has happened to me while growing up. You know, my siblings and I, all kind of things has happened to us. But I feel as though if my mother was here, it could have been a little different. You know, things could have went a little different because, you know, in due time, people do change. But the things that my siblings and I have been through, I mean, it only made us stronger, but still it's not right.
She also told us her mother has come to her in her dreams.
When she came to me, it was always to let me know that I was expecting a baby, every single time.
Jennifer also believes that Deborah's spirit is restless and wants the case solved. She even believes Deborah played a role in our decision to cover the case for this podcast.
For you to pick her, that lets me know she wants her children to know exactly who killed her. And hopefully the police can find who this person is, because the kids are broken, even though they're adults, even though they have children of their own and husbands of their own, it still plays in the back of their minds and it never leaves because it's unresolved.
If you have information about the 1994 murder of Deborah Perry, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-888-CRIME-SC. The Deck is an Audio Chuck production with theme music by Ryan Lewis. To learn more about The Deck and our advocacy work, visit thedeckpodcast.com. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode and another special surprise. So, what do you think, Chuck? Do you approve?